get started with the panel, I'll go ahead and let the panelists each introduce themselves. First, I'm Josh Hall, Associate Pastor here at First Baptist Church, so welcome. Glad to have all of you here today, and I know you had no trouble finding parking by virtue of your presence here, so outstanding.
Good afternoon. I'm Derek McGee, pastor of Bible-based church here in Tallahassee. Like my friend at the very other end, Jack, this is our
sixth season.
So Jack and I have been here from the very beginning, and it's a great honor to still be a part of this.
Father Tim Holita, Co-Cathedral of St. Thomas More.
Betsy Willett-Zierden, pastor at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church.
Rabbi Jack Romberg from Temple Israel, and I have to say that on this Sunday, April 9th, 10:30 to 4, the Jewish Food and Cultural Festival, if you really want some good, you know, deli and great baked goods, just come on and hear some great music and stuff. Come on out anytime. If you go to church, come right after church. We got lots of good stuff for you.
Excellent. Well, today we're going to be talking about echo chambers. And if you're not familiar with this concept of echo chamber, it really became a part of, I think, our national vernacular back in November when folks were trying to explain the unexpected outcome to the election. And yeah, if you're not familiar with it, the idea of an echo chamber is you get in a group where you keep hearing other voices and you assume maybe there's diversity, but it's actually just echoing. You're just all hearing the same perspective. You might be hearing from different people, but they're all really just saying the same thing. So you delude yourself into thinking that you're hearing from multiple folks and therefore you're getting multiple perspectives, but you're actually just hearing the same perspective echoed around and around. And this is becoming more and more of a problem, I think, in our culture as we become more and more dependent on online interactions, digital media. So whether it's Twitter or Facebook or even you're searching for the news through Google, every one of these is a filter of sorts. And what we often don't realize is that they are customizing those results based on preferences that you've shown. So the more that you click on an article on Facebook, you're going to get more stuff just like that without even asking for it. You know, depending on how you search for stuff in Google, Google's gathering a lot more data than just the term you put in. So two different people can put in the exact same search term and get different results. But assume that you're seeing what anyone else would see if they searched for that term. So we've got this issue with echo chambers that I think has been exacerbated by our reliance on online media. So before we go any farther with today's topic, I just want to go ahead and open it up to the panelists. What's wrong with that? And before we assume that that's a bad thing, what's wrong with getting my media from a what might be an echo chamber? I mean, after all, I'm hearing from people I agree with, so isn't that a good thing?
Actually, everything is wrong with it.
Okay, here we go.
Because as the old man on the panel, even older than you, Betsy, but as the old man on the panel, I like actually remember the days when you would turn on the nightly news and, you know, or read the papers and you believed in journalism as, you know, that element that brought you what was happening. And the existence of echo chambers, and I've noticed that actually on Facebook, for example, Josh, and I purposely try to search for and click on articles that are the opposite of where I'm thinking to kind of screw them up and try and get, but the main reason why everything is wrong with this whole echo chamber thing is because you never start to hear what the other person is saying. And when you don't hear what the other person is saying, even if you disagree ideologically, there are a lot of times very good things coming out of the other end of the spectrum that you need to kind of think about and maybe integrate into your thinking. So rather than evolving as thinkers, we are stagnating as thinkers because we just, anybody remember Fortran? Okay. Anybody remember what a do loop is? Okay. We are stuck in intellectual do loops, just repeating the same thing over and over and over again. And that's a trap. That's a trap.
I mean, I think we're all going to agree that it's not a good thing. What frightens me the most is that it just continues to contribute to polarization and divide and misunderstanding, so that when you when you finally do talk to, and I know you're going to challenge us on this, but when you finally do talk to somebody honestly that thinks differently than you, you've got all this, like, ammo for your position. And they have all this kind of presentation of their position, and real conversation is really affected by that.
Just went blank, and I think I'm the youngest one up here.
What is this age thing today?
On it today.
It sounds like ageism.
When Jack started, is
ageism. Have we done one on ageism yet?
We might actually
yet?
Be sitting in order of age. We'll have to. Like
Except I think now. Actually, I think you're younger.
Shall we show our IDs?
Subconscious.
No, Tim's the youngest, so we're out of order. But I agree. I definitely think everything wrong, with it is wrong. I also think that it grows and then it factors into your faith. But I think what ends up happening is you have Christians who want to be around Christians, and Jews only around Jews. And then you start having the segments within Christendom, for example, where, you know, you got to be a Christian conservative. So I think that starts playing into it as well. And I think it's one of those things where anyone who thinks other than you, even on one small segment, the judgment takes place. I think the other thing that makes it the more challenging, I think that's how cultic behavior begins, because it gets to that point where you find safe haven in just that thinking and that dogma until you prevent yourself from thinking outside of it. I think Faithful Friday is a good example of the counter, because it's us being here is not an uncertainty of our own faith and our belief in what we believe in, but it is actually availing ourselves to hearing from others who don't see everything the same way we see it, and being okay with that. For example, you know, I mean, listen, I'm a black Republican. I mean,
that's a small echo chamber.
Echo chamber, very, very small. But
do you talk to yourself a lot?
I was always told, as long as you don't answer, you're good to go. So, but I think it starts playing into the faith-based community in that regard. I think it starts happening in our pulpit from a Christian standpoint, because we go to certain viewpoints. If you're a conservative, Fox News become your echo chamber, things of that nature. And I think it's very, very dangerous, because then all of a sudden the next generation feel like they have to make a decision as to how they behave because of that echo chamber.
I'd just add a little bit, I guess, that I think this goes hand in hand with the sort of crisis of values we talked about last month. There's a crisis of truth. And when I was a kid, I remember my, you know, father telling me, "I don't believe everything that's in the paper, right? In the newspaper, they have a bias." I was like, "Wow, that's interesting." Growing up, I remember talk radio, because at least for conservatives, it seemed that the national news media was biased, and so talk radio became an alternative to that. And then I guess Fox News became an alternative to the major networks and so on. And now there's MSNBC as well, and they're kind of catering to a particular audience. The problem is which one's true, right? Fox says they're fair and balanced. Well, people who aren't conservative laugh at that, right? People who are conservative think, oh yeah, this is fair and balanced. So the problem really, to me, it's the echo chamber. Yeah, but where do you even go? I mean, I want to read something true. The other day I was watching something. I don't like to watch the major news networks much because it's an industry, but I was watching it to try to get some information. And they had two people debating from both sides of the aisle. And it was amazing, right? They were both contradicting each other in an incredible way. And I'm left there thinking, like, if I'm really trying to understand this issue and not cheer for the person that I agree with or be mad at the person I disagree with, if I'm really trying to get to the bottom of this, I'm left clueless, because then it's commercial break. You know, there's no resolution. It's arguing with each other. And they're so contradictory. You wonder if anyone even cares anymore about these issues, or it's just a game. So I think it's not just the echo chamber. It's a crisis of truth in a sense in our culture, just like with values.
And what you're describing there reminds me too of this issue that we have with, we just want to have an opinion and share it more than to understand anyone else. And I'm getting ready for this week. I came across this proverb, Proverbs 18:2. A fool does not delight in understanding, but only wants to show off his opinions. I think that's like some life verse for some folks on social media. When we look at, when we're talking about echo chambers, and one of the things
that...
What
did you say, that's 18.2?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look it up on my
There we go. I was about to say we're going to get a different one.
I'm going to go look at the Hebrew.
I was waiting on it, actually. I did pause before I put that in there. But I think when you look at like a church or a synagogue, we are by design an echo chamber of sorts. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, but we, you know, our walls reverberate with shared values and beliefs. But here's what I think is unique about our faith communities is that we also, by design, seek to understand those outside of our faith tradition. Even if it's just to be able to interact with them on matters of faith or maybe even persuade them to the truth of our position, we want to understand them, but not just in a sense, hopefully, like what Betsy was pointing out, of just wanting to be able to, like, here's where you're wrong, here's where I'm right, but to actually genuinely understand where they're coming from. And I think that desire to understand others demonstrates the value that we place on them as individuals and the respect that we have for their ideas. Because if I don't want to take the time to learn how someone thinks or feels, if I'd just rather have my own opinion, then I'm just not even going to interact. I'm just going to ignore. But the fact that I'm seeking to interact conveys respect for the other person. All right, here we go.
You want a direct translation from the Hebrew?
Please.
Okay. You want to hear the Hebrew?
You can do that first, absolutely. Okay.
Lo yachpotz kusil b'tmuna. A fool has no delight in understanding. Ki im itgalot libo, but only in revealing his heart.
Yeah.
And actually, libo, lev in biblical Hebrew does not mean heart, it means minds or thoughts.
Yeah.
Very good.
Actually, that just made me feel better about my translation, so that's good. I was getting anxious there, and I'm like, okay, so far so good, so far so good. So that being the case, this I think experience that we have as faith communities, what I'd like to hear from each of you right now is how you specifically in your role as clergy or as a person of faith, how have you stepped out of your own echo chamber and sought to understand the beliefs of others?
I became friends with Jack Rungberg.
You beat him to it. I think he was trying to say that.
No offense, Derek.
Uh-oh.
But actually, yes, I became friends with Derek McGee, and I love it, love it. But what really started to push me out of my echo chamber was getting to know people at First Baptist Church. Because coming from the North, as a Jew from the North, I had read all kinds of things about Southern Baptists, including a statement by a Southern Baptist leader from back in the early 90s who said that God doesn't hear the prayer of Jews. Well, you know, that kind of sticks in your head. But in this city, and I think there is something special about Tallahassee. I do. I think this is a really beautiful community in a lot of ways. And in this community, it started with Doug, you know, Doug Dorch. Who reached out to me and made it clear that there was no judgment on his part. In fact, he was very concerned about the Jewish community at some point way back about, you know, 10, 12 years ago that he talked to me. And it continued with Fran, you know, Fran Bueller, who, by the way, Audrey and I consider Fran and Nancy, you know, friends of ours now. We love getting together with them. You know, when it came to Episcopalians, you know, Dave Killeen is sort of like my Christian doppelganger in a lot of ways, you know. You know, when it comes to Methodists, you know, Betsy, you know, was a natural friend. But getting to know people from Southern Baptist groups, you know, and to see that what the prejudices that I kind of was trained to have two, 3 decades ago, you know, 2.5, 3 decades ago, actually aren't always true. And that has broken my bubble in a lot of ways and made me much more, you know, open to hearing the thoughts of Derek. My connection with my relationship with the Catholic Church actually goes back to childhood, and it's always been a very positive one. So I've always been open to, you know, friendship with the Catholic Church and represented the Catholic Church.
You remember you were Joseph in the Christmas play one.
I was Joseph in the kindergarten Christmas play in West Virginia.
I remember that.
And And when I was in high school, there was a Catholic priest that I had gotten to know because we took an adult education Hebrew class together. His name was Ed Conley, Father Ed Conley, and he was the teacher of religion at Central Catholic High School in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And he invited me to bring some of my students, some of my friends, to his classes to teach them about Judaism. And I stayed friends with Ed. And a number of years later, when I was in college, my dad was in the hospital. And Ed, it was a Catholic hospital, and Ed had been transferred to be the chaplain of the hospital. And I came back from college to see my dad because he'd had surgery. And I walked in, and there was Ed sitting with my dad. And he said, "Jack, great to see you. I'm going to take you out to lunch." So we went down to lunch, and he said, "What are you planning on doing after college?" And I said, I really think I want to be a rabbi." So this Catholic priest looked at me, and he said, "If you became a rabbi, I would be so proud of you." You know, so those are the sorts of things that do break your bubble.
I think what's been challenging me is that, as you've heard, if you've been around a while, I have a congregation that is sort of represents right, left, and middle. And it's always been a great strength and a great joy, and it made us, I think, stronger. But the politics of late have personally challenged me so much as a pastor, because I don't want to stand in the pulpit and appeal to one side or the other. Now, the Christians among us can say, well, the gospel says specific things. In fact, the gospel does say specific things. And the gospel is always for the one that is the outcast and the immigrant and the downtrodden. And yet, recently I preached a sermon, a Pharaoh rose up who forgot Joseph, right? And the persecution started little by little, and the heat got turned up, and the Jews were enslaved. And I said in that sermon, a new regime arose, and I deeply offended some people because they thought I was directly referencing Trump. Now, perhaps I was subconsciously, or maybe even a little consciously, but the point is, I am educating myself to try to be aware of the various issues by taking the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and reading from as many conservative and liberal progressive news sources as I can, because I want to be balanced. But at some point, I have to be prophetic and speak what I believe the scriptures teach. And so I'm in an uncomfortable place currently. I'm not really sure how to guide this flock that seems to suddenly be really uncomfortable at times. And I think that the discomfort in our culture and our nation is sort of trickling in to places that used to be safe and joyful.
What you guys, any ways you've learned others' beliefs?
Working with, you know, being with you all and getting to know you all has been one of those ways, of course, these discussions. I'm blessed that in our priesthood, our presbyterate, in this diocese, we have a pretty wide range of feelings and thoughts when it comes to politics. So our get-togethers are quite entertaining. Add a little drink to it, and it's all right. And but if you remember, I brought this Father Dustin here, who's a death row. You know, he's helped out a lot, and I brought him. Him and I would disagree on so many issues, but we have the greatest discussions because he's sincere. He wants the truth. He's going to treat me. I have tremendous respect for him. He has respect for me, and that's why it works. I just had lunch with Jim over there, Jim Lyons. He's doesn't believe in God. We had a wonderful, didn't we? We talked for like an hour and a half, 2 hours. I think we had just a great time together. I've been recently going on campus. Some of you may have seen this on the internet. It kind of, I have 15 minutes of fame from it, with a sign that says if anyone wants to go to confession, have questions, or just want to talk. So reaching out in that way, making myself available. Socrates talked about people, if they want truth, you know, those are the people he would work with. It's much like the proverb. Those who don't aren't sincere in seeking. They just want to hear their own. You know, it's not much I can do for that, you know. But I love talking to anybody who disagrees with me if they're sincere, if they're actually interested in the truth. And I think let's start with that. There was a principle also of being charitable. And I think we're reading the news. It would do us all good to apply that, to look at something, no matter who we're reading about, and saying, you know, what if, what's the best interpretation possible? What if this person really, you know, what does this person really want? Are these people evil? You know, are they all in elected office because they're wrong, or they're seeking their own gain, or are they really seeking the good? And they just disagree on how to get there. And how do I best interpret this from world powers, from our own country, from our own officials, and from our neighbors, to try to apply that, give people the benefit of the doubt. It's a Christian way of looking at things, that probably not just a Christian way. I think that helps also.
And for me, briefly, I think it was two facets. Number one was turning the TV off. So I actually operate in a political world, and it's my profession. And so because of that, you know, you consume a lot of information that you want to stay abreast on current events. But at the realization of it all is turn the TV off and actually going back to an old way of doing things, which is face-to-face interaction and conversation with people. And then secondly is I've actually allowed myself to be involved in more boards. I used to always be no on every board opportunity I had. People would call me, no, I don't want to be on that. I'm too busy. And I've since said yes to a few boards that I actually thoroughly enjoy being a part of. But doing that with two things in mind. Number one was to be able to be in a room with people that may not agree with everything I agree with. Number one. And number two is really, you know, I always operate on the assumption that I need to always be a black person in every room. All right. So I always say, I'll be the black on that board. But here's the reality of that is you would do that with the assumption that the people in the room were anti-black in their thinking, only to go into a room and realize that there actually is a real sensitivity to people on the other side of town more than you think it is. And so I bring that up because sometimes in order for the echo chamber to be burst, is you have to look at yourself in the mirror and realize you may be the one developing the echo chamber. You may be the one thinking that because you're the black in the room that no one can speak on behalf of black but you. You may be the one actually keeping blacks impoverished versus helping them be liberated. And so in some conversations you've been a part of, you realize that. And because of the way in which I grew up, it's easy to get into an echo chamber because you always have to blame your struggle on someone else. You have to say it's the white man or someone's holding me down. And so you develop these mindsets where somebody has to be to blame for everything. And then it becomes easy to grow into the echo chamber and remain there because guess what? I can justify having this anger. Justify having this position. And then what Bessie said, I agree with, because my struggle pastorally with this is I pastor a great group of people. But the vision that I have for our church is a very multicultural, intergenerational ministry. And I say that because people in some of my parishioners have never been exposed to a non-black setting. And some of them don't want a non-black setting. Whereas with me, you know, I converse with all, so our Wednesday night service now, I'm starting to have politicians show up that I invite from the Capitol, have them come, because listen, we profess to be Christians, to have them come over. But in that, it's been eye-opening to realize this echo chamber is not something in D.C. I'm dealing with this right in the church where I pastor. Because there are people who really don't want that. But they're talking about a heaven they're all going to be in at the same time. So I can relate to you, Bessie, with my point with that struggle, because it definitely is that.
So to build on where you were going with that, the question is, how do we as members of a civil society, how do we escape the echo chambers? What guidance can you provide to folks here today for things that we can do?
I'll jump first and then pass down. I'll jump right where Tim was. Tim did something that I don't think I would have done 5 or 6 years ago, that, and I think Faith Through Friday has played a major role in this, is when you had lunch. Give me your name again. With Jim, who going into it, he knew that he and Jim didn't share the same beliefs. But it didn't stop the idea of them sitting down, breaking bread together. And I was always raised that there are so many things can be resolved with food being in the room. Just around, and I'm really talking about more about being sitting at a table, having a real conversation. And I think that's part of it is having the willingness to get outside of yourself and sit down across the table from people who don't see things the way you see things and engaging in those conversations And that's how Jack and I came to realization. We actually shared more. We had more in common than we realized. And I wasn't trying to convince Jack or transition Jack from Judaism to Christianity. But it was really more of developing a friendship and a rapport, but also a trust factor. And I think for all of us in here, it's a personal commitment that you're willing to make a phone call, sit down with someone, and have that real conversation. And it's challenging because just so happens you may find out in that conversation that you're not perfect. You don't have all the answers. Tim and I had lunch at BJ's and had a great conversation. And it was always funny. I don't know if you noticed, people were walking by, we were sitting there talking, and he was dressed in his priestly garments. People were walking by looking at us. It's almost like one of those jokes. The joke of, so I saw a black guy and a priest at BJ's. But it engaged into a conversation. We are talking about various things in life that you normally wouldn't be exposed to if it were not for settings like these where it pushes you think outside that box. Because it's easy to be around nothing but black preachers, and the whole conversation is about how good of a preacher you are and how big your church is, how many degrees you have, only to leave out of that setting and realize I live in a culture where people are not just black preachers.
I was going to talk about you, so then I'll let you talk. No, actually, I invited everybody to come to dinner at my house one evening, and the two teetotalers, I'm assuming, were out of town, so they weren't there. So instead, we had we had Jack and Tim and myself and my husband on our back porch, and these two, the rabbi and the priest, they do not see eye to eye. And they were polite and collegial earlier in the evening. No, they actually were all evening, but it was so refreshing and sometimes funny, and then sometimes a little like, really, you think that? And I'm going, really? You think that? So one of the things that I've already shared with Josh that I think that we are going to do is we are going to model getting together socially and having those kinds of fun and heated at times conversations. Because of our friendship, we can do that. And maybe if we can do it with each other, we can do it with those that we're not quite close to.
So I'm going to take a little different tack, a little different direction. Just to, and to go back to your question, give a little different approach to the answer. But first of all, Derek, if I would have been at that lunch, we could have made a joke about a rabbi, priest, and a minister, you know. So, okay. So if, you know, for those who, you know, are part of Temple Israel and have been coming to Friday night services in February, March, I think we have points in our lives where we have maybe three sermons that we want to give. And so my Dvar Torah is what we call the comments that the rabbi makes. It literally means words of Torah. Okay. So the Torah portions through a lot of this time were centered upon the building of the Mishkan, which is the portable sanctuary that the Israelites take through the wilderness with them. And there's a number of many chapters that are part of that. And then it's interrupted by the golden calf. That whole sequence is interrupted by the worship of the golden calf, and then by Moses' reaction, and then his going back up onto Sinai and his talking with God about, okay, what do I do? And needing to be convinced by God to continue. So I've had a certain theme that I've kind of continued very consistently with the messages that I've been giving. Number one is, don't just read the building of the Mishkan, the portable sanctuary, and all of this coming together, this place where God is supposed to dwell. Because that's the thing, is at the end of Exodus, God comes down and dwells in that place. Don't just read that as a literal building of this thing for the Israelites in the desert. Read it also as a metaphor for each of us building a sanctuary for God within ourselves, a place within our own hearts and souls for God to dwell. And then I tied that to the idea of whatever is happening out in the world, you got to listen. You got to listen to the other side. You have to listen to what people are saying. It's so easy to jump off the wagon and to start screaming and yelling about sick. Now, are there moments where I take a stand on a particular issue? Absolutely. Okay? And last Friday night, I was actually talking about an issue, and I said, I'm at the point in my career, I don't care if anybody disagrees with me. I don't. I'm at the point in my career, I really don't.
I'm younger than you, so I'm not there yet.
You're not there yet. But the main thrust of my messages have been build that sanctuary for God within, and as you build that sanctuary for God within, listen.
That is a Christian word, too. That's from the Gospels. So there again.
I just want to add one thing. We had in our readings the other week the healing of the blind man in the Gospel of John. And the idea that we don't know we're blind. I mean, this is what you think in your own life. In a time in your life where you held a position or had feelings towards, you know, something that you don't anymore, that you've changed or you've grown. And you had no indication back earlier that you were wrong, perhaps. And now you see things completely different. And to recognize that maybe, you know what, there's still maybe a sense there's a place of blindness. And if we can start with that, and that maybe my neighbor is blind as well, let's talk about this and go on a journey and search for that. I think if we start there, instead of who's on what team, and partisanship, and ideology and so on, I think that that's a much more positive way to begin, is recognizing, you know what, I don't know everything. There's ambiguity. Hey.
It's Lynn.
She disagrees? I don't know.
There's a voice from above.
Shh. You're getting something here. The end.
Almost the segue, I was about to say. All right, so here's the lightning round question real quick, and the panel already knew that this one was coming, and then we're going to your questions. One of the things that we talked about, and Betsy alluded to it, you know, reading the Wall Street Journal, looking at other sources. So real quick, what are some sources that you could recommend to folks that are maybe on the other side? Because, for example, you know, if you're on the left, the caricature of right-wing news source is Breitbart. And if you're on the right, the caricature of left-wing news source is, I don't know. So what I'm saying is, what would you...
MSNBC.
Okay, there you go.
MSNBC.
So it's one that you would consider less reputable than is what I'm getting at. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, real quick, from the panelists, to offer to this group, what are some that you would consider to be a reputable source of information about that if you're more conservative, what are some conservative sources? So I'll get the ball rolling, for example. So like a Heritage Foundation, I'm going to consider them more reputable than, you know, Breitbart. Or from a Southern Baptist perspective, our Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, ERLC, and Russell Moore, I'm considering that's a reliable source. If you want to go to see what a lot of Southern Baptists think, that's a good source to go to rather than just the caricature or the blog post. So real quick, if you've got any suggestions to the folks where they can go and look for reputable information, fire those away, and then we're going to the crowd for questions.
MSN.com.
What is
it? MSN.com.
I don't really. I mean, I try to read. I don't have. What
perspective? And it could be anything. And I'm thinking, because you mentioned radio, a Twitter follow, someone on Facebook. It could be an online news source. Anything that you say, here's a good one that's worth following. We're giving recommendations. Because we're getting to our homework assignment here.
I find reading both, you know, Maureen Dowd and Peggy Noonan to be an interesting, you get two different takes.
That's a good example.
So I know people on the right will hate this, but frankly, yes, and I understand that the editorial boards of these two papers lean left. However, the reporting of these two papers are excellent, and that's the New York Times and the Washington Post. The writing is excellent. The reporting is excellent, and it's only ideological blockage that prevents you from saying, "Oh my gosh, that actually." And by the way, I also say think the Wall Street Journal. I put it in the same category. They're all very good papers, and I don't care what ideology you are. They are all newspapers that should be read. If you want to get a good source a website where you go on and get a sense of a Jewish perspective on things, go to the Religious Action Center, which is the Reform Movement's political arm in Washington, D.C., and you'll get a good sense of where the bulk of the Jewish world comes in on certain issues.
I would agree. I read all of those, and I have gone to Breitbart because I was curious to see what was going on there. But speaking of Twitter, I have one ultra conservative, like far right friend that tweets things that I just like shudder, but I don't block her. You know what I'm saying? Like I hear things that I don't agree with, and I allow myself to hear that and also sometimes to follow her links because I recognize that most of my tweets are from people that sound like me, more or less, progressive Christians, that kind of thing. So I won't say her name, but I'm going to see her because we're still in a dinner group, a ladies' dinner group, and I thank God for her because, man, she opens my eyes and helps me to consider a different perspective.
And so we're now turning to you, and we're about to have your questions. The homework assignment that we, and I talked with Liz about this, that we're encouraging you to engage in over this break between this last Faith Food Friday and when we resume again in the fall is to identify some new sources or voices that you can try to tune into to help you get out of your echo chamber. So it might be a personal relationship. It might be a new follow on Twitter. It might be a new magazine to pick up or a book to read. But try to intentionally find someone who is going to say things that maybe make you uncomfortable, but you may, and they're not that you're trying to be persuaded, but that's going to help you understand them better, going back to our proverb.
And I just want to add one more thing. So one of the things I look for, speaking of looking for truth, is if I read three different newspapers that are from three different perspectives, and the reporting is very similar. I think, well, we're getting close to truth because it's been presented by three different people, slightly different ways, and they're saying the same thing. I find that to be helpful.
So I got so excited when Josh said homework. And I sort of started unspooling a little bit. And I love to name things. Until somebody comes up with a less corny name, we're going to call the summer swimming against the tribe. So we're going to actually sort of develop some resources on this. We're going to listen to what you say. We're going to listen to what they said today. We're going to throw out some ideas of sort of easy things that we think you can do to just sort of have, you know, dip your toe in the water of a different way to think, which really has amazing positive repercussions. We'll email everybody who's here, and if you don't get emails from us, just leave your email address on the table with a link that will be sort of our Swimming Against the Tribe page. And I'm thinking, again, because I'm so excited about the homework, that we, like, do it every summer. We challenge people over the summer when we have fewer programs to sort of challenge themselves.
We're going to have a pool party.
Yeah, that's right. We could go really nuts
picnic.
Here.
Picnic.
That's right. Bipartisan swimming.
Yeah. Red and blue bathing suits.
There you go. No, everybody should be in a purple bathing suit.
And so now we're ready if y'all got any questions.
I have a question. This is the echo chamber comment. Or the echo chamber that I hear, and it's coming up, will be coming up in Easter, and it usually comes up at Christmas. I'm just curious, and Jack, you'll chime in on this too, but do you, as a Christian, feel that you are under attack constantly? And the reason I bring that up is that there's a current two bills in the House, and one in the Senate and one in the House here in Tallahassee, legislation that would grant special privilege to religious beliefs in public schools. And this came up, and someone told me, and it's been many years since I've been in public school, and many years since my children were in public school, but I heard that in public schools, you are not allowed to wear a cross or a Star of David or any other symbol of religious. Right? Is that true? And what is your, do you believe that you're under attack?
I don't believe we're under attack. And that's not true. I had a sixth grader mother send me a poem that he wrote in public school because she was so proud of him. And the poem was on Jesus, and it was very well done. And he was asked to read it to the whole class in a public school.
I will say some of that can vary by school district. So this, again, when we're stepping out of our echo chamber, that I don't presume that just because in Leon County schools is the same as Duval or Dade or somewhere up north or out west. So you do see that difference as well. One thing that I'm always keen to distinguish is, you know, I always grimace when I hear Christians feel that they're persecuted because the person at Target didn't say Merry Christmas. And then I'm seeing what happens to Christians in the Middle East, and I go, y'all got to check your definition of persecution here. I read what Paul went through. I'm like, till you've been stoned and left for dead, you've not been persecuted. You had your feelings hurt, maybe. You know, and so I'm not minimizing that, but that is, I think sometimes we're limited in our vocabulary, so we just label it all as being persecuted.
And I'm assuming you meant persecuted or attacked here in the U.S.
Not good at speaking. It's really not a question. It's kind of an observation. There are many kind of bubbles, and what I've been trying to do is come out of my white bubble of privilege and trying to read more. Things like the New Jim Crow, articles, you know, books of that type, Just Mercy, to get a perspective of people of color and what they've had to deal with in our country for decades, centuries. That's been an eye-opener. It's not easy reading, and we've also, through The Longest Table, made two beautiful friends who I might never have met otherwise. We've broken bread together on numerous occasions, and I've been able to talk firsthand in that way, too. So going to things like this, The Longest Table, reading authors who might be a little difficult to read, I think those are some of the bubbles we can break out of, too. Make us all come together, no matter what, left or right, you know, and understanding.
You guys know about the filter bubbles, too, the digital ones that you're in. So Google has analytics, and so do newspapers in some ways, that give you more of what you click on. So you can actually sort of create a universe of your own making by clicking first on certain things, and then you sort of start to feel like the world is all agrees with you, and that's one of the problems we're having is then we step out into the world and we go, wait a minute. You know, so you kind of have to do cross-clicking, too, to get.
Hi. First, thank you for doing this. My question for you guys is, what do you do when someone from your congregation or anyone that comes and talks to you asks a question but has those blinders up and doesn't really want to hear what you have to say?
I listen, and I try to approach it as I am offering them a pastoral presence for them to talk. So I don't try to disagree or argue, or I just let them be where they're at. It sounds kind of simple, but if we more of us just let people be where they're at, they may move to a different place.
I'm a little bit more, not aggressive, but no, that's that would be the wrong word, but assertive, yeah, maybe that's the what I try to do with somebody who comes to me and they clearly are stuck in a particular mode is I you're right, listen. You have to listen, okay? But I try to find something that they're saying that I can affirm as correct and true or give my feeling of understanding for that, and then add on, you should consider, this approach or this perspective that somebody might feel this way. And I found that generally, if you can affirm somebody's feeling and show that there is a piece that you agree with or that you have sympathy to, that opens them up to hearing something a little bit different. And then you just play it as it goes along, or I do. In other words, if they start to break down and become more open, that's great. We can have a real conversation. If the wall is really up, then I don't push it. I just listen and say, well, I hope you consider such and such.
And adding on to that, I think it's also important to recognize and realize in that setting, in that scenario, that person, there's other contributors to that person's thinking than just your response. So you may find yourself responding to their direct question, not realizing there is a root cause to the question that you don't see on the surface. And so the listening part is the most important. I was educated years ago in a conversation with a guy, and he gave me this great quote from an unknown person that says, listen with the intent to understand, not with the intent to respond. And that's really been helpful for me as a pastor, because when people come to you, your first thought is to give an answer. And sometimes it's really more of them saying something, but realizing that you may be the only person when you respond that actually takes the opposing side. And that could be hard for them to digest as well, but also not taking it personal, which is easier said than done. I used to always get offended when I would talk to people about when I first became a believer of Christ, and I would go talk to people about Jesus Christ, and they would shun me. I would take it so personal, like, you're going to hell because you won't talk to me. And then, you know, you start maturing in life, you start realizing that, you know, a quick 5 to 10 second encounter with somebody is almost insulting to them, because it's almost like you're coming through, giving them a sprinkle of water, and you're moving on. You never took time to really invest in who that person is. And I think the same thing in that scenario is there's other contribution and contributing factors in that regard. And I think this most recent presidential election was a good point, because there were people who would take position quickly for or against whether Trump or Hillary. And if you didn't have a position, they got easily offended, not realizing what led you to that thought process. And I think that's very important. And then the last thing is recognizing, realizing that no matter what you say, it may not change the person's thinking at all. And you have to be okay with that.
What makes me think too, in your quote, I heard it said, listen as if you're wrong, argue as if you're right. You know, so it's that notion of, like, if anyone who knows me, I'm a big believer in absolute truth. And that was part of the discussion we had, you know, last month. But at the same time, I've got to recognize there are some things that I believe that are wrong. I just haven't figured out what they are yet. Okay? But in the meantime, yeah, there we go. Betsy's telling me one of them right now. You know, but it's one of those things that I have to have. So I'm not saying that I abandon my convictions. No, I hold my convictions firmly, but I do so with humility. You know, so I'm still gonna be convictional in how I approach faith and life, but I'm gonna do so with humility. And to Jack's response to your question, it just reminds me of the credibility that you can establish with someone else when you'll acknowledge truth that you see in their position. I think part of where it's become so easy for us to become exponentially polarized over the past 6 to 18 months is because we won't even acknowledge if someone else has a nugget of truth in their position. You know, I was moved by Bill Maher, who's not a guy I tend to agree with, when he acknowledged after the election, I'm paraphrasing here, that he was wrong to have been so critical of George Bush and Mitt Romney. Okay? Because what he recognized is he spoke about them in the same terms that he was speaking about Trump. He lost all nuance. And so for those of us on the other side from him, it's easier to turn that off, because if you don't have the nuance to see the difference between W, Romney, and Trump, I'm not sure you're looking at the same stuff I'm looking at. And I'm not taking pot shots at anybody. I'm saying those are three very different guys.
As a frequent watcher of Bill Maher, because I really enjoy his show, because I actually think a lot of times he tells truth that people don't want to hear. And really? That was a moment of truth. When Audrey and I were watching that and he said those words, we turned to each other and said, that's absolutely correct, because I would have never, ever... there's so many things I disagreed with W on in terms of politics, but I never doubted his decency as a human being. And if you can't see that difference, then where are you?
I went over here. I don't have a question. I just have a comment. We're in the middle of the National Public Radio Drive, and I want to put a plug in for listening to NPR to get news that encompasses lots of different perspectives. 1A, which is taking the place of Diane Rehm, you're often going to hear people that argue from different sides of things. And I think those types of civil discussions inform us. I also received the Washington Post digitally, and I have the option, and do, to send a news, I don't even know what they call it, but a a list of articles that comes to me as news, but I also have a list that comes as opinions, and they have many conservative commentators as well as liberal commentators, and I read them all. I mean, I think a good news, a newspaper like the Times and the Post are going to give you different perspectives under opinion.
Yeah, I agree, Debbie. That's what one of the reasons why I like the Times so much is because I read Ross Douthat, I don't know how you say his last name, and I read David Brooks, and I think they are fabulous commentators on what's going on in the world, and I like them as much as I like, you know, Friedman or Maureen Dowd or, you know, whatever, the people who tend to write the things that, oh yeah, I like that, you know. But I that's why I like the Times and why I like the Post is because they give not only good reporting, but it's different perspectives and honest different perspectives. So.
Any further questions?
You have a quiet crowd today.
Let me just echo something while we're getting to that question. Let me echo something that Jack just said. I think it's particularly helpful to look for conservative writers in liberal papers or liberal writers in conservative papers. I agree with you about Ross and about David Brooks. And I do want to mention for any of you who are still on the fence about coming to the dinner, Pete Wehner, who will be coming, is a conservative writer who writes regularly for the New York Times. So what I think is particularly useful about these kind of folks is that they are trying to write in a way that people who disagree normally with them will hear, which is different from someone who is simply writing for their own kind. So I think Pete will be great. Just had to put in that little plug.
I enjoy George Will, too, when he writes about baseball.
Hi, hello. To me, churches, to go back to speak directly to that, it's easy for a church to become an echo chamber, which we talked about because of the shared faith, but also typically people like bring their friends to church, you know, and they build through networking in that way. And so what I wonder is, as church leadership, is diversifying your congregation something that you like are cognizant of or like intentional in, or is that something you have lots of other concerns and, you know, you're more from like a pastoral perspective rather than?
That is primary for Good Samaritan, which is why I think I'm struggling. Our vision is to be a church that reflects the diversity of heaven. So we recently had a young woman from the LGBTQ community lead our worship service, and she was amazing, just amazing. And I didn't get any overt pushback. In fact, most people really enjoyed her leadership, but there was an undercurrent. So we're still struggling, but we say that's who we are, so we're trying to be that.
So I would say that I believe in Mark Twain's quote, heaven for climate, hell for society. So I think we're trying to actually, you know, reflect the earth, you know.
If you go to a parking lot of Catholic Church, especially during the election, you're going to see bumper stickers and ideologies and things from every perspective. Which makes it a challenging, you know, you don't want to offend people. Yeah, just try to preach the gospel. But that's the thing that holds us together is our Catholic faith. And there's sometimes disagreement on that too. But even like I said earlier about amongst the priests, I just had dinner with the bishops of Florida because they were here for that Red Mass. They're not all in agreement either, you know. And they have interesting views. I mean, you take Archbishop Wenske, who's pretty famous. You know, I think he was on Colbert or somewhere. Well, that's a great example. Stephen Colbert is a Catholic, and so is Sean Hannity. Right? Very different of beliefs. If you looked at our communion line, I think you'd be impressed. There's no social engineering, yet there's people from India, Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America. I've seen Australians, there's Europeans, you name it, African Americans. And there's no intentional, like, hey, let's get more black people in this church, or, you know, maybe we should, because we live, my church in particular lives and on the edge of Frenchtown, and we don't do anything. Even I've talked about this. We don't really do a lot to actively reach out to people there. But there is no social engineering, and I love it. I think it's beautiful. It doesn't seem to be part of our consciousness, and so I don't think it's something we worry about or think about.
I have a question here.
I apologize. It's a comment, not a question. But to combine physics and philosophy, it is impossible to see the world and impossible to get rid of an echo chamber unless you take down your walls.
Who are you quoting?
You know, I have to add what I think is a truth. I think it's a truth that in, for many of us, our political leanings are overcoming and overwhelming our faith inclinations. I think that we are allowing the political world to actually drive us, in ways of that's affecting faith. That's affecting the morality that we draw from our religious backgrounds. I see this all over the place, where people are compromising what should be their moral background based on their political perspective. And that, to me, is a big problem.
All right. Last one, and then I'll close it up.
I just want to respond to that as someone who walks the tightrope between agnostic and faith-based. And I find that the political climate right now is leaning me more toward the faith. Just to contradict what you're saying.
Thank you.
Because someone like me who's like, okay, well, what do I have that will give me support when I look at this absolutely uncontrollable situation in our leadership right now? The only place you can look it up. Because, I mean, look at Syria and Sweden. I mean, seriously, what are we going to do about this? So I have no control. So the only place that I can see is to look to faith.
I don't think I was then clear, because that's not really what I was trying to say. I'm not saying that it's driving us away from our faith. I think if you are a believing Christian, I'm just giving this as an example because it's the first that pops in my mind, but I know I can think of examples on the left too if I have enough time. But if you're a believing Christian, how do you accept the morality of some of what our president has done? I don't understand that. I don't understand. I'm talking about attitudes towards arranging with women. Or to put it in a clearer perspective, married 3 times, divorced twice, relationship with women. How do you accept him and condemn our just prior president, not recognizing that he was, if you disagree with all of his politics, that's fine, but not recognize that he was a model family man. That's what I'm trying. That's the kind of compromise that's happening, is that people are then quick to condemn President Obama based on their disagreement with policy. That's fine. I mean, disagree with policy, but not recognize that the Obama family is a model family. Okay? And I'm sorry, but our current president and his attitude in terms of his relationship with people is not a model. You may agree with policies and so forth, and that's fine, because there are going to be some policies that we all will finally say is good. I mean, I think a lot of us might say that the response to what's going on in Syria was maybe okay. Okay? But from a moral perspective, we're compromising our moral perspectives because of our political beliefs.
So isn't that sort of when we have gone full on tribe, right? Yes. And we're tribally divided in every aspect of our lives, including too often in faith communities, along one dynamic, left and right. And that's where, I mean, we've always believed that the faith community is one of the most important ways to solve this problem.
And I think that rather than making our starting point our political belief and then judging from that perspective, I try to make my starting point my religious/moral belief and then judge from there. And what that means is that there are conservative Republicans in this town that I have very close relationships with and respect tremendously, and I think that they work only for good for our community, and I will vote for them. And I will vote for them. And there are are liberal Democrats that I want to have nothing to do with because I feel that, that there is something morally wrong. But there also is on the other side. There are conservatives or people that I disagree with politically that are morally wrong, and I cannot accept, I will not accept them because I think the basic morality is wrong. And so my starting point is from my position of faith and the morality that it teaches me to adhere to.
Well, close us. Appreciate your time today. Close out with one final thought. We talked a lot about ways to get out of our echo chambers, but just a reminder that ultimately the solution is not going to be in answering how, but answering why. It's not going to be in finding another strategy or a new source, but instead the attitude. Do you really want to know what other people think? Do you really want to understand what someone else thinks? Because if you really do want to know what someone else thinks, you're going to find a way. And if you really don't care what they think, you're just going to find an excuse. I'm done.
Thank you. We'll see you next fall. And thank you to the God Squad as usual.